Bill Resnick today leads off interviewing Joel Jordan, a longtime high school teacher in Los Angeles, a writer, an activist, an organizer, a leader in the Radical Caucus that managed to gain power in the Los Angeles Teachers Union. They discuss the recent rising of teachers in two waves. The first, the takeover of local teachers' unions by progressive forces in quite a few big cities, among them Portland. The second, a segment wave of rank-and-file led and organized strikes in several red states, including West Virginia and Arizona. Bill?
Joel Jordan, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Glad to be here.
Joel Jordan is a longtime high school teacher in Los Angeles, an activist who writes a great deal, a leader of the Radical Caucus. 2005, the Radical Caucus managed to gain power in United Teachers, Los Angeles. It's the LA Teachers Union. Joel, for the last 20 years, public education has been under attack, defunding by state legislatures, and campaigns funded by the boy billionaires to replace public education with charters or privatized corporate schools. The teachers' unions, of course, tried to resist, not very successfully. Recently, teachers have fought back in two waves of struggle. The first was a couple of years ago in a number of school districts, bigger school districts around the country. The radical caucuses would take over the unions. It happened in Chicago, partly in Portland and other places, including, of course, LA United. You were a leader of that caucus and became an official of the union. Recently, the second wave of teachers came in West Virginia, Arizona, Kentucky, Oklahoma, all red states. Without collective bargaining, they organized from below. They went on strike. Some won a good deal. Joel Jordan, tell us why the rank and file have organized over the last several years in those ways. And
sure. Well, generally, as I'm sure your listeners know, the conditions for teachers have always been not as good as they should be, and particularly in urban areas, much worse. And the reasons for that are both external and internal. And externally, we've seen, particularly again in urban areas, which I taught in, you know, most of my working life, over the last 10 years, especially increases in poverty, homelessness, low-wage work. That brings students stressed out into the schools, which creates problems within the schools that schools are not very well equipped to address. And then on top of that, internally, you now have had since even before No Child Left Behind was passed in the early 2000s, the testing regime, so that teachers are under huge pressure to measure teacher effectiveness by test scores alone. It hangs over the head of most teachers. The amount of paperwork has increased over the years. And generally, the administration, feeling the pressures from above at the school, then put more pressure on teachers to perform, and that means that teachers are facing a huge amount of stress. And I would say that that's the case regardless, blue state, red state. This is true everywhere in the country, as these tendencies, these trends are national. They're not local or statewide.
Right. And increased class sizes, particularly in California, and increased student mobility. Kids are moving in and out of classes, particularly in poor areas where people are being forced out, the foreclosures. The school is facing and being affected by all of the problems of low-income people.
Absolutely.
So, Joel, give us a sense of the teacher struggles in the big cities, and then sort of compare that to what's happening right now, which is the red states.
Well, in the urban areas, at least of California that I'm familiar with, I worked for years in Los Angeles schools, and now I work with teacher activists in the urban areas of Oakland, San Francisco, Richmond. And there are big discipline problems in the schools now that need to be addressed, that actually divide teachers in terms of what they think needs to be done, although there is general agreement that counseling services are practically non-existent in high schools. The ratios of students to counselor is like 1,000 to 1, 900 to 1,000 to 1, so that actually no counseling goes on of any substance in these schools, and therefore behavior problems or acting out problems are generally dealt with punitively, which doesn't work. And so that's one consequence of the stress that is brought into the schools. As far as how this relates to the red state struggle, to make that transition, there the issues have been a little different. I mean, just take West Virginia, for example. West Virginia, class size in West Virginia is significantly lower among the highest class sizes in the country. And so the issue of class size, you didn't see that coming up so much in the red state struggles because, in fact, in those states, class size generally is lower than it is in many of the so-called blue states, and certainly California. And that has to do with per pupil spending to a certain degree. West Virginia per pupil spending is 50% higher than it is in California.
Yeah, I was amazed by that.
I've always known that California had low per pupil spending, very high student-to-teacher ratios. It has always been the case. And in these red states, the issues had much more to do with, at least initially, with the different forms of compensation. And they found that because in these red states, the Republican legislatures had made draconian cuts in the education budgets that went along with cuts in corporate taxation. So they cut corporate taxes, got less money, cut education as well. Those things went hand in hand. And so the fight in these states initially was really around compensation. In West Virginia, the publicity was that, you know, it was around salary, and they did get a 5% increase in their salaries, but at the end of the day, but the real fight was over the increases in health benefits costs that they were fighting. And so compensation is so bad in these states that all of them face enormous teacher shortages. Now, that the teacher shortage problem is national, but it's especially a problem in those states because of low salaries, cuts in education spending, and declining health benefits.
Tell me about the UTLA. That was the urban district. What was UTLA, that is the radicals that took power in UTLA, how did they try to deal with these questions? And with the questions of charter schools and the rest?
Well, the caucuses that have, the radical or social justice caucuses that have taken over UTLA over time, I mean, I have to say that in 2005, the caucus took leadership partially, and it's only over a matter of years, and actually since 2014, that the caucus has actually completely taken over that local. But the issues that started it were the fact that the leadership of UTLA was a traditional business unionist or service unionist leadership that relied on good relations with the school board at a time when the school board, well, at least the LAUSD administration superintendent, was unwilling to give the teachers a decent contract, and the union did basically nothing from 2004 to 2005. And so the caucus, which is called United Action Caucus, built itself on the grounds that what was needed was a militant organizing strategy to fight for a decent contract, because the union leadership had gone 22 months without a contract, without being able to negotiate one. So that was the immediate cause of it. But what we always fought for, and which gave our caucus enormous support among the rank and file, is that we took up issues of class size, which was something that the union leadership had always said before, oh, no, we can't take up class size. That's a state issue. It's too much money. We just have to fight for salaries. And even then, they didn't really fight. So the very limited approach to teacher conditions on the part of the leadership and the unwillingness to fight on the one hand, and the caucuses identifying of a broader set of issues, classroom conditions issues as well as compensation, was the basis for the victory of this caucus, both then, 2005, and going forward until today.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mill Variety Hour. I'm talking to Joel Jordan, an activist teacher. He writes, he's a strategist. He's, what I didn't say in the beginning is that he is now a coordinator, one of the coordinators of the California Alliance for Community Schools. Joel, let's talk about the goals of your caucus, one of which was community schools, of really changing the structure of the schools, changing the way the curriculum, changing the culture of the schools, and changing the relationship to the administration of the school, with teachers having a far more collegial, and also changing the relationship to parents and organizing parents. But tell us about all of the efforts that were made within those L.A. schools. You had, 1,000 schools in L.A. that you were representing at that time?
900.
Only 900. There were struggles in many of those schools to really improve the schools, was my understanding. Tell us about it.
Yes, the fight for community schools is really in a somewhat of a beginning phase over the last few years. You might have seen that the Chicago Teachers Union negotiated in its last contract agreement, negotiated a clause that set up something like 50 community schools in Chicago. Right now, UTLA is engaged in contract negotiations with the district and is also attempting to get the school district to fund and support the community schools. And also UTLA is attempting in the legislature to put forward a bill that would fund community schools. And I just want to say maybe a few things about what community schools are. They really cover 5-6 areas. And let me just say that the impetus behind community schools was really as an alternative to charter schools and to privatization. It was to this idea that instead of charters, which are all about testing and discipline and authoritarian discipline, they tend to be privately run without control of teachers and parents and community, zero tolerance discipline policies that are meant to push out kids who may have some behavior issues.
And huge turnover of teachers as well. That a bit less well known.
Absolutely. So the thought behind them is to develop a culturally relevant curriculum in these schools, student-centered, that emphasizes high-order thinking, teaching that's done collaboratively, where teachers work together to develop lessons and evaluate those lessons and make appropriate changes in them, so a collective approach to the teaching profession, leadership, as you said, that would be shared with the staff and with community and parents and students where appropriate. Positive behavior practices, what are commonly called now restorative justice practices. So instead of just harsh discipline, you know, expulsions and suspensions, that there's resources for peer mediation and real counseling so that students actually learn from their behavior and learn from each other. And also family and community partnership, where the decision-making overall in the school is shared with the community. And finally, and what community schools are most known for, but it's only part of the vision, is community support services, provision of kids to students with meals, health care, mental health counseling, and so forth, and also to offer some of those services to the community as well, to sort of integrate the community and schools together. So that's a vision of the school that we put forward as an alternative to privatization.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole talking to Joel Jordan, an activist and teacher, activist, strategist, writer, and organizer of the California Alliance for Community Schools. What about the schools of education? My understanding is that many of them, in fact, have not changed, but many of them have, and their teacher training now is moving much more towards these more engaged curriculum, dealing with local subjects, having students examine their communities, reading community history, and looking at U.S. history in a very different model. Are new teachers coming out with those, at least expectations that the schools that they're going to work in have those ideals?
Yeah, in fact, there's an entire cohort of social justice teachers, teachers that are teaching in both traditional schools and charter schools, who are very much about social justice in the classroom. One of the challenges, I think, that those social justice educators have as they come out of some of the schools of education which have this orientation is that, of course, they come up against the testing regime, the top-down management of many of these urban schools that a lot of these teachers go into, and basically try to do what teachers have always done, is to sort of hide behind closed doors, teach a curriculum that they want to teach, and having a struggle with the site administration over that. And so that's a tension that goes on day to day, particularly in urban schools, with young social justice teachers. Many of those teachers also see the unions as kind of irrelevant to the work that they're doing in the classroom. And that's a challenge that some of the unions, the more progressive ones, are beginning to take up, which is to link social justice education in the classroom with unions and with union demands, so that, for instance, the demand for community schools having a social justice curriculum is the kind of thing that has begun to attract younger social justice teachers into the union, whereas, you know, even the demand just for lower class size itself is not enough, even though obviously lower class size is a necessary condition for doing the kind of teaching that engages students in the way that they need to be.
One last issue. It seems to me the West Virginia teachers in particular, they saw their struggle not just in terms of the teachers, but of the whole staff of the school and, in fact, all state employees. That's a radical break, it seems to me, from what teacher unionism has become. Get as much as you can for your staff, and some of the weaker unions who represent teachers will have to do with less. Often it's just a fight about who gets what out of the state budget. And this was, my understanding of West Virginia was, they were in fact speaking for all public workers and public services. And that seems to me something really quite remarkable, actually.
That's right. And it has to be looked at in the context of a fight that targets the state as opposed to a local district. The traditional teacher union, and not just teacher unions, but other public sector unions, tend to bargain with entities that themselves do not have revenue-raising power. So school districts generally do not. They do not have taxing power. And because of that, there is a tendency in collective bargaining states, and by collective bargaining, I mean local district collective bargaining, there is a tendency then for teachers who tend to have more power and more influence than the other classified unions in that district that represent, say, bus drivers and cafeteria workers and sometimes teachers' aides and so forth, that because there's a limited pie to go after and no chance to expand it through taxation of any kind, there's a tendency toward basically screwing the other unions in order to get something for yourself, given the limited pie. But what made the West Virginia struggle and the other fights so different is that they targeted an entity, the state, that could actually raise taxes, and that's what they demanded, that taxes be raised or at least not further cut, like in Arizona that had a old history of cutting public education at the same time it cut corporate taxation. So what, for instance, the Arizona teachers demanded was an end to cutting corporate taxes, and in fact are now fighting for a tax on the 1% to pay for increased education funding. So that's a very important thing to understand, that these struggles were against the state, and that the power of the state to tax and raise revenue is key to making the kinds of more general and broader demands that were made in West Virginia. So in West Virginia, the health plan that covers teachers covers all state employees. The raise that the teachers wanted for themselves, since they are basically state employees, their employer is the state. It's not the local district. It's the state. And so these teachers demanded, why should they be different than other public sector workers? And then so they, because their employer is the state, and because they could demand taxes that could pay for improvement of salaries as well as of health benefits, it created a sort of, you could say, a material basis for a much broader struggle. And of course they understood that in order to make their fight and to popularize their fight in the face of the Republican legislature's resistance to even giving them 1% pay raise, that they had to broaden that struggle, and they did. So that's definitely to their credit for having done that.
Yeah, and another thing in West Virginia, they went on strike. And they went on strike throughout the whole state, and they prepared for it. It was very remarkable, actually. It sort of put the strike and almost the general strike strategy on the agenda. It made it clear that workers could withhold their labor and, in fact, require the employers, with the state or a private employer, to, although more difficult in some ways.
That's right. The state unions, the AFT and NEA affiliates in West Virginia, for instance, had been fighting for an increase in compensation for the longest time. It didn't ever get anywhere. And why did it finally get somewhere? For exactly the reasons that you said. They struck. They created power by doing so. They created a crisis that forced the legislature. This was a legislature that finally wound up, all these Republicans, all of them wound up voting for this 5% pay raise, whereas none of them were prepared to do this before the strike, indicating the power of the strike. Having said that, I would also argue that a strike is in itself not enough. I'm concerned that in the aftermath of these strikes, not just in West Virginia, but in the other states, that the tendency is to say, well, we need to elect teachers to the legislature as Republicans or Democrats to further our program of increased education funding. And I worry that that will lead to the dissipation of energy and the co-optation of energy. And in fact, it could lead to going back to the preferred strategy of the labor officialdom and the teacher union officialdom. Whereas what I think is needed in these states, and the strike creates the power and the influence to perhaps make this happen, would be the development of some kind of ongoing political organization that continues to fight, that actually organizes direct action and continues to do that, and also runs people for office on a program set by that organization instead of relying on the Republican and Democratic parties, which in fact have been the part of the problem, not the solution. And the likelihood of these teachers who may get elected to the legislature being able to transform either the Republican or Democratic parties, I think, is illusory.
Joel Jordan, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
Now, you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. Got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, won't be long. You got shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay, take your kids to the seashore. Of course, it ain't quite that simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Because if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be waiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be better.